Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Last week, surrounded by fellow lawmakers, Washington Senator Patty Murray introduced a new bill.
Menopause is not a bad word. It's not something to be ashamed of. And it is not something Congress or the federal government should ignore. Menopause is something that every woman goes through. So there's no reason that any woman should feel like she's going through it alone or like she can't find reliable information or the healthcare answers and options she needs. And there is no excuse for shortchanging this issue when it comes to federal dollars.
With a $25 million price tag, the Advancing Menopause and Midlife Women's Health Act would expand federal research on menopause and women's health, establish a national public health awareness program, and support the improvement of professional training for healthcare providers. And it has a lot of big bipartisan names behind it. Republican Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is a sponsor, as are Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins and Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar. The push to destigmatize menopause, invest in research, and improve training for healthcare providers comes in the wake of new research on the safety of hormone therapy for younger menopausal women. So there's a lot to talk about when it comes to women's health and aging. And to help us through it, we reached out to Dr. Andrea LaCroix. She's a distinguished professor of epidemiology at UC San Diego. And Dr. LaCroix also spent many years here in Seattle working with medical institutions like Fred Hutch and the University of Washington. She started by walking me through the basics, what menopause does in the body.
We're actually born, girls are born with ovaries that contain the full number of eggs she will ever have to be reproductive. And as we get older and towards the average age of menopause, which is 51, the number of eggs that are available diminishes, and it sets in motion a process where the ovaries will cease to function because their job is done. And it's a very gradual process. What happens is hormonal fluctuations and the stages of menopause start to be set in motion. In general, we think of it as estrogen going down and certain other hormones going up.
And that leads to what types of symptoms?
That leads to symptoms like hot flashes and night sweats in some women. For many women, those symptoms will be mild and tolerable, and for some women, they'll be too frequent and too severe to ignore, and they'll affect daily life, they'll affect work, and be annoying, you know, and also confusing, because I think the experience of having a hot flash, we should talk out loud about it a lot more. My experience with it was that there was this aura before a hot flash happened that felt like something was going to happen. It felt like almost anxiety producing. And then when I actually had the hot flash, I realized, oh gosh, that's what that was about. That's what that feeling was about. I think we need to talk a lot more just about what it feels like to have a hot flash. And
did it feel like your body was going into fight or flight?
It felt like something was up that was uncomfortable. Something was going to happen. Like a little bit of a rapid heartbeat, and something was building up in my body. And then the hot flash would happen. And it was like, oh, that's what that was about. After a while, I came to recognize that beginning part of it and wasn't as alarmed by it. But I was really alarmed by it at first because I had no idea what was going on. And that's the kind of information that we rarely share with each other as women. You know, there's just no way that people who haven't gone through menopause would understand how this feels without us talking out loud about it.
I want to get to this legislation that Senator Murray has introduced in just a moment. But first, there's been a significant update to a long-term study published last week on the issue of menopause treatment. And this has to do with the safety of hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, to treat hot flashes and other symptoms. This was based on clinical trials conducted for the Women's Health Initiative study that started in the 1990s, which you've been involved with for more than 30 years. So what is the latest on what we know about the safety and effectiveness of hormone replacement therapy?
Well, there's a new paper out this week in JAMA summarizing the Women's Health Initiative trials, including the hormone therapy trial, the calcium vitamin D trial, and the dietary modification trial, and looking carefully at the results and how to clinically translate them. What do they mean for women? What do they mean for doctors who are counseling women about whether or not to take hormone therapy or calcium vitamin D or to practice a low-fat dietary eating pattern? On average, women in the trial took hormone therapy for 3 adherent years. The intention was 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 years at the beginning, but because there were safety concerns, both of those hormone therapy trials were ended early by the National Institutes of Health and the Data and Safety Monitoring Board. But we have followed women and learned so much about the impact of that period of taking hormone therapy on health in postmenopausal women.
And doctor, I think that when those trials were ended early, there was this worry that went out across the medical field and across, women who are facing menopausal symptoms that said hormone replacement therapy is dangerous. And there was a drop off in women taking hormone replacement therapy, even if they were under age 60. And I understand that this has to do with, you know, the sample size of who was, you know, part of these clinical trials. Maybe it was skewed to an older age set, but also to a lack of understanding of what the data really meant. How did this happen? And what have we learned in subsequent years about the safety of hormones, especially for women who are going through menopausal symptoms under the age of 60?
Well, I think we've learned so much from where we started. I think the first thing to say about understanding the Women's Health Initiative trial is it was a trial to see if hormone therapy was useful for prevention of major chronic diseases like heart disease, like fracture, like whether or not it might protect against certain cancers. And it wasn't about whether or not hormone therapy was useful for control of hot flashes and night sweats. That was already known. And the women that entered the trial might have had hot flashes and night sweats, but they had to be willing to be randomized in the hormone therapy trial. Women who were taking hormone therapy for menopause symptoms and who felt that they didn't want to stop wouldn't have been eligible for the trial. So this was not a trial about whether or not hormone therapy was useful for management of menopause symptoms. And when we published the results, I mean, what was a surprise, women were 50 to 79 at baseline. We definitely wanted a certain number of women in the 60 and older group, because that's when the risk of chronic diseases like breast cancer, heart disease, stroke, and fracture, that's when we start to be at higher risk. We did have plenty of women in all these age groups, and over 32,000 women were in one hormone therapy trial or the other. The estrogen plus progestin trial was stopped early because of an increased risk of breast cancer that crossed the safety boundaries. We were not sure if estrogen plus progestin increased the risk of breast cancer, and this trial brought to light that there was an increased risk. The other thing that emerged from this trial and another trial called the HERS trial was that taking hormone therapy increased the risk of heart attack and stroke in the first couple years of treatment. And we didn't know that either. And this was shown both in women who had never had heart disease before and those who had a history of heart disease in the HERS trial. So from the prevention standpoint, estrogen plus progestin, it was felt to be known in 2002 that this medicine shouldn't be used for prevention because you shouldn't have to trade off prevention of fracture for an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and breast cancer. I think that's a pretty simple statement from the trial.
Do you think, though, that the release of the research in 2002 and the way that it was interpreted by doctors who maybe weren't equipped to interpret it and not as knowledgeable about treating menopausal women helped push a lot of women under 60 away from a treatment that could relieve their symptoms? And why do you think that happened?
Well, I think it happened because it was scary. The results of that estrogen plus progestin trial, it was scary. We didn't know about all these disbenefits, and suddenly we did. We never said that the proper interpretation was that women shouldn't take this for menopause. In fact, the original, interpretation of the trial was that by the FDA and by various bodies was to take the lowest possible dose for the shortest period of time. I think the important takeaway message here is that there's a lot to know, and there's hormone therapy for management of menopause symptoms and several other treatments that are perhaps not as effective, but almost as effective, and that women deserve to know the evidence and what we've learned over the last 20 years, so that they can make an educated choice about what they want to do if they're symptomatic. It's not just one thing, it's many possibilities and the freedom to choose with knowledge. And so for the hormone therapy, I would say, look, here's what we learned in women in your age group. The risks are uncommon, and the benefits are relief of symptoms, but not a cure for menopause symptoms. So even if you look at low-dose hormone therapy versus the other options, you're looking at, on average, a benefit of 1 to 2 hot flashes a day in highly symptomatic women. And it's not like if you come in with 12 hot flashes a day, you're going to be completely cured of hot flashes. But many women feel great on hormone therapy and really appreciate the relief that they get. Some women take gabapentin. There's a new drug on the market called Veozah, that is newly approved by the FDA for relief of menopause symptoms, and it compares very similarly to hormone therapy. So there are just many, many options, and each one has its risks and benefits. And I would want women to benefit from all that we've learned in making those decisions.
Is it fair to say that the results of the long-term study that you were involved in, the Women's Health Initiative study, which is ongoing and you're still involved in, were misinterpreted by a certain set of doctors because there was a lack of training overall for how to approach menopause, and in fact, a lack of funding for research into menopause? So maybe one data set would be blown out of proportion or in other ways, read into inappropriately. Is this a symptom of a broader issue here, doctor, that there needs to just be more investment into this space?
I think it's very hard to change paradigms in medicine, even with strong evidence that perhaps the paradigm should change. And, I reflect on that a lot. Just because we have a body of evidence that's constantly evolving doesn't mean that prescription practices change in concert with that. I don't know why it takes so long. I think possibly because they do say that medical school education around menopause is very, very, very brief and not very in depth. And so it does seem like that could be improved. And as well, the education of women, just as they grow up, girls, we've talked about how much did you learn from your mother about menopause? How much did you learn in school when you started to menstruate? How much do boys learn about the menopause experience in women? Why do we keep this so hidden in our entire society. You know, it just seems like it's very much under wraps. And it should just, you know, be something that we all learn about as part of entering puberty. You know, when menses start, what is the life cycle of reproductive life in women? And, you know, middle school kids have mothers going through menopause. Wouldn't it be great if they understood what was happening?
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great if they understood that for their entire life, so that when it happened to them and in their environments, they were not thinking that this was a big surprise. I think what we're seeing in society right now is a more vocal population of midlife women who are saying, "Hey, why didn't I know about this? Why aren't people talking about this?" And I think that's such an important question for us in society as a whole.
So the Advancing Menopause and Midlife Women's Health Act is attempting to take a crack at this. You know, you mentioned that people in middle school have parents who are going through menopause. I mean, that was my experience that, you know, just at the peak of hormonal, awful teenager behavior, I had a mom who was going through menopause. And we just had, you know, a really interesting few years there in our household. And I think understanding more about the process of menopause and being able to talk more openly would have helped so much in understanding exactly what we're going through and other families we're going through. What did you think when you heard about this legislation, and what kind of impact do you think it might have?
Well, I'm just thrilled that women's health is back in the news and back as a priority. You know, the Women's Health Initiative would not have come about without a line item in the congressional budget that got passed, supporting the start of the Women's Health Initiative program with kind of the same enthusiasm that we're seeing today. And we really need to continuously do Women's Health Initiative programs as medicine and the opportunity to test new medicines evolve. We've learned so much about the natural history of menopause that women deserve to know. You know, the range of experience, how it varies in different race ethnicities of women, how long it lasts, for example. The study of women across the nation studied the natural history of menopause across the United States in various race ethnic groups of women. And taught us that symptoms last, you know, way longer than, you know, people might be thinking, oh, if I go into menopause, it'll be over in a few months. It's really many years that this whole experience takes. And I think, you know, I think if you understand what's going on in your body and how these symptoms might arise, what they might be, what ways there are out there to alleviate them, it can just be very empowering. So that's what we're really pushing for is I think it's great to have $25 million a year allocated to menopause research and more broadly to valuing improving healthcare for women of all ages, because I really do think that across the reproductive space, I mean, women are premenopausal until they go into menopause, and we have a variety of issues from adulthood to the end of life that have not been paid attention to for many years. So I'm thrilled to see this investment, and I hope it carries forward to all the stages of women's lives.
Many physicians say they had received little to no training on menopause and menopause treatment. I mean, only 31% of surveyed OBGYNs in 2022 said they had a menopause curriculum in their residency training programs. And patients and providers have said that they have been confused about potential treatments. If so few OBGYNs have this kind of specialized training, the general healthcare community seems to be woefully undereducated in this space. I mean, what can be done to fix this, doctor?
Well, I think medical school curriculum can value teaching about the menopause transition. I know here at UCSD, they've expanded that curriculum and called upon those of us who do research in that space to participate in improving education in that realm. It seems like a very straightforward and easy thing to do. And for providers that are already post their educational training, it should be easy to get, it should be easy. I don't know if it is to get state-of-the-art continued medical education to learn what there is to learn. And I don't think it's all that difficult, but I think choosing a provider that stays up to date in this space, if you're seeing someone for treatment of menopause symptoms, is a really smart thing to do.
For anyone who's listening right now who is maybe perimenopausal or bracing for that menopausal stage of their life, what would you say to them in terms of how they can best prepare themselves with information and this variety of treatment options that are available to women right now?
Well, what I would say to them is there are a lot of reputable resources out there to learn about what's happening in your body and the options for treatment of symptoms. We have a website that the Ms. Flash investigators developed with NIH funding to start that process. And it's called mymenoplan.org. It's not a flashy commercial website, but because we're just professors at universities trying to disseminate knowledge in this space. And we did it with very little resources, but it's a resource you can use to begin to understand what's happening. And I think it's really important to seek out reputable information about the menopause transition. And by reputable, I mostly want to emphasize that it's really important to get this information from outlets that are not trying to sell you anything at all. Because I think that the desire to make money from women going through this experience creates a bias that we can't ignore in the outlets. So I really think it's important that that we get information from strong evidence, well-conducted studies, and think through with support, hopefully, what that means in terms of what we want to do in terms of our own self-care. The other thing that's worth mentioning is just being listened to. Menopause occurs for women at the intersection of sort of ageism and sexism. Women in our
Yes.
society who are post-reproductive are less valued. And the keeping of the menopause experience under wraps is probably influenced, let's say, by that issue.
Yes, it's a period of your life when you start to feel invisible in a lot of areas of society. And then to be going through something that has been under focused on by the medical community, you have a double sense that you're not being listened to, not being paid attention to. And that is a really outrageous thing to think about when we know that half of the population will be going through this at some point in their lives. Dr. Andrea LaCroix is a distinguished professor of epidemiology at UC San Diego, and she also spent many years working here in Seattle at Fred Hutch and the University of Washington. Dr. LaCroix, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate you walking me through this and talking about this potential new push to see more training and funding for menopause research at the federal level. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and a shout out to all my friends in Seattle.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m., Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.